Light Dealer presents your favorite friends from Gasoline Alley.
Hold it, Wilmer. Hold it till I get this phone.
Okay, Skazek.
Wallet and Bobble Garage, Skazek's Wallet speaking. What's that? Oh, yes, sir, we can fix it. We can fix anything on four wheels. Sure, we'll be waiting for you right here in Gasoline Alley.
Yes, it's Gasoline Alley, the comic strip that's a favorite in more than 100 great newspapers. In this episode, The Adventure of the Musician's Ignition, the very slippery Mr. Chiggers comes in with a very strange request that his auto lights be wired for sound. But first, a word from the friendly auto light dealer in your own hometown. Gasoline Alley. A new construction firm, the Cutler Company, has just moved to town, and of course all the garages are trying to get the Cutler repair work. Well, this morning Wilmer has not yet shown up for work, and Skeezix has just entered the garage office when...
Wallet and Bobble Garage, Ski 6 Wallet speaking. Good morning.
Mr. Wallet, this is Mr. Cutler, the Cutler...
Actually, it's the Ink Stud speaking. This is Ink Stud's radio show where we talk about comics. Today, I'm joined by my good friend Colin Upton.
Hello.
Hello, and I have two guests who I'm going to bring on the air now. I have Jeet here. I got you there, Jeet?
Yep.
And Mr. Chris Ware?
Hello.
I got you? Okay, I'm just going to turn you guys up. Do-do-do. Don't mind me while I test my sounds. Jeet and Chris have been working hard on, so far, three volumes of the Daily Collections and recent release, the Sundays Collection from Sunday Press Books is the name of it, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And it's a beautiful edition, one of the largest books I've seen.
Yep, I guess he started a new trend in publishing, it seems. There's with his Winsor McKay book now... Sammy Harkham is planning the next issue of Kramer's Ergot to be that size as well. So.
Is it actually that format size?
The exact same size.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I knew it was going to be a massive tome, but I didn't know
it will be.
No, the
dimension. It'll have to be new kinds of bookshelves. Now there's three books that are officially that size.
It's dwarfed your early Acmes or the I guess, the novelty collections editions and the Raws.
They are deeply dwarfed.
So, and just so listeners know, Chris is the author of the Acme Novelty Library, which has a new book coming out in December, as well as a sketchbook collection. And Jeet is one of the leading academics, I guess is a good phrase to put it, in comics opia.
Yeah. It's sort of like being the tallest building in Kansas City. But I guess I'm one of the leading comic scholars.
And it's something we appreciate because you've definitely, with the Walton Skeezix collection, have gone full out in your knowledge, in your sleuthy ways of being able to investigate and write up and bring about the information of these great the great talent.
Hey, you know, can I say something?
Shoot.
I can hardly hear Jeet. It's like he's turned into the incredible shrinking comic scholar. It's like an inch tall or something. I don't know if this is going to be a problem unless... You either want me to just, like, rudely interrupt him because I can't hear him or say things that he's already said because I genuinely can barely hear him.
Here, let's try...
Yeah, I'm having the same problem at my end. I can hear Robin very well, but Chris is, like, kind of distant.
Yeah.
Can you guys hear each other better now?
A little bit, yeah.
I've got you pretty much... Yeah, you're cranked up, so...
This is live radio.
Yeah, this is, unfortunately, the perks of having a college radio station and being able to... do the kind of shows that I want to do without any outside interference is the limited facilities.
Well, that's fine. All right. Well, we'll do our best to be heard.
So. Okay. Well, I guess I'll start out with who was Frank King?
You want to take that, Jeet?
Sure, yeah. Okay. Frank King was a cartoonist at the early part of the 20th century. He worked for the Chicago Tribune, which, in terms of comic book in comic strip history, was became the dominant newspaper for comic strips. In the very beginning of the 20th century, you had the newspaper, New York newspapers like Pulitzer and Hearst that were doing Crazy Cat and Little Nemo. But by the 1920s, there was a shift to story comic strips that were more narrative-based and more about ordinary life. And Frank King was very much a part of that. He created a comic strip in 1918 called Gasoline Alley, which was initially a sort of panel strip, but changed in 1921 when a lead character, Walt Wallet, discovered the baby Skeezek. And then it really became a comic strip about fathers and sons, and was, I think, really unique with in terms of the fidelity with which it displayed ordinary life in America. And a lot of people at the time really loved it for that reason. Over time, it's sort of gotten forgotten, and the books that we're doing are an attempt to bring Frank King back into the limelight.
Now, it's for you, Chris, this has been kind of a lifelong ambition, is bringing these collections out.
Yeah, I when I was a cartoonist at the University of Texas at Austin, where I went to undergraduate school, I first saw Frank King's comics at a comic convention. I bought a big stack of them, and I'd never really read it before, and it was sort of a revelation for me, because it was the first strip I read where I felt that there was really a sort of soft and gentle mood communicated without sacrificing any of the more kind of energetic and I don't know, for lack of a better word, dramatic aspects of the comics medium. I kind of just fell in love with the strip for again, lack of a better, more articulate phrase, and tried to collect them wherever I could in the days before eBay, and then even in the days after eBay, tried to. And apparently Joe Matt was doing the same thing, but with an ardor and enthusiasm more appropriate to his personality. So this book collection, finally, when Chris Oliveros decided to take on the kind of questionable and massive task of reprinting all these things, this all comes from Joe's virtually complete and obsessively filled-in collection of daily strips. But yeah, personally, I in a lot of ways, I feel I feel closest to Frank King as an early cartoonist, pretty much probably than any other cartoonist. There's something just about his very direct emotional warmth that really, I don't know. I'm very inarticulate. I should preface everything I say with this. My thoughts just kind of trail off and fizzle into nothing. So I'm really bad at this. So anyway.
Can I add something to what Chris just said?
Can I just very quickly? Can you guys hear each other okay now? We tried doing some tweaking.
Not really, but that's okay. Whatever. It's like.
Yeah, that's okay. We'll say the same things, but I just wanted to add something to what Chris said, which is about the sort of Frank King and contemporary cartoonists, because I don't think it's an accident that Chris fell in love with Frank King, as did Joe Matt, as has sort of Seth and Chester Brown. I think for a lot of these cartoonists who in the 1980s and 1990s were struggling with trying to do comic strips that were do comic books and graphic novels that were very honest and dealt with life and dealt with what it means to be alive, and not do genre work, not do cliche science fiction or superheroes. A lot of these contemporary cartoonists were drawn to Frank King because he offers a sort of model. He was somebody from the early 20th century who did a vast amount of work, but whose artistic intent in some ways really speaks to the moment. And if you look at someone like Chris's work or Seth's work, there's a real attempt to capture the ineffable, to capture quiet moments, to capture, you know, those aspects of life that are very subtle and personal. And you see that in Frank King. So, I mean, that's why for someone like Joe Matt, you know, in his pantheon of pleasures, it's like masturbation is number one and frenching is number two.
Right.
Yeah.
That's pretty much stating the obvious.
Right. Geez, well, I shouldn't even be saying anything at all because Jeet is so much more articulate than I am, and English isn't even his first language. So I should just hang up right now.
Anyway. Oh, we have you on the air. We're going to keep you on.
Well,
now.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
In your like pursuits of the comic artists of the early 20th century, late 19th century, it seems like Frank's work, as you're saying, is a lot warmer and gentle than a lot of other stuff. Is that something he was kind of going into, is like with the introduction of Skeezix, was to try and do something a little different than the other stuff?
I think, I mean, it's hard to say, I think, but I'm pretty sure that he was thinking along those lines, because we've, through the great generosity of Drana King, who was King's granddaughter, and basically the reason that these books have happened, aside from Joe Matt's collection. Jeet and I have traveled down to outside of St. Louis, where she lives, and spent probably a total of 3 or 4 days looking through her personal archives that she inherited from Frank King, which include probably, I can't say really thousands of family photographs, but certainly hundreds of family photographs and personal documents, including Frank King's diaries. And in one of them, when I was leafing through it, I found the phrase, well, now, of course, I can't remember it, but essentially it said something along the lines of thinking will affect a few people, but a touch of the heart will affect millions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that indicates, I don't know where he wrote it down or if it just occurred to him when he was on the train one day or if it's a quote, but I think it's pretty clear that he was trying to do something that was...
Oh, you guys still there?
I knew I shouldn't have paid for caller ID when I got my calling plan.
No, they're just trying to fix the phone line so you guys are louder. I've been written down notes for the thing. Oh, that's loud.
Anyway, I think that's in a very long-winded way. I'm trying to say I think it was intentional on his part somewhat. And I sometimes kind of wonder when I think about him, I wonder if maybe he was taunted a bit by some of his fellow cartoonists. Maybe Sidney Smith gave him a ribbing every once in a while for being a little sentimental, because he sometimes veered into some fairly... sketchy emotional territory. He was very experimental, and there was a few strips where he drew Uncle Walt's face really close up and tried to do these sort of chiaroscuro techniques of amplifying the facial features and sort of filmic techniques in a way, but not really. Like he was really trying to do different things and create a sense of emotional empathy with the reader that I think a lot of other cartoonists probably would have eschewed, if not made fun of. So, but I'm going out on a limb.
Well, that's something I've noticed in the third book, was really that heavy use of silhouettes,
mm-hmm.
and the black and white. Was he like trying to experiment through the daily strips, not just the Sunday strips?
Oh yeah, I think actually there's probably just as much experimentation in the daily strips, and I think most cartoonists at that point knew that the daily strips were most likely to be read by adults. And that the Sunday strips were aimed more at a child audience. I think that probably carried on well into the 40s or 50s. It kind of continues today, actually. So.
And that's something we should actually mention for people, is that Gasoline Alley is still a running strip.
But not in the paper in which it originated, though. I think the Chicago Tribune dropped it something like 8 or 9 years ago.
To a hushed quietness.
Yeah, apparently so.
Now, is it the longest running comic strip?
I don't think it is.
I think that Cats and Jammer Kids is still running or ran until a few years ago, so that's
probably
the longest.
And I think Bringing Up Father is running too, which may be the single most iconoclastically weird strip. I mean, even Blondie is weird, you know. But I don't think it's the longest running. I think it may be the longest running continuing narrative or continuous narrative, if you want to consider it that.
At nearly 90 years, it's definitely dwarfed anything else.
Is Walt still there?
He is. So that means he's about 135 years old, I think. So.
But Phyllis passed away a couple of years ago, if I understand. Or last year, was it?
I think so. Wait, was it Phyllis or was
it Rachel? Phyllis died a few years fairly recently, but the rest of the cast, either the characters like Doc sort of fade away and aren't seen anymore, or they're still around. So Skeezix is still around, and he's I guess 90 or something like that, which is
right.
kind of weird.
They've got really good health care plans.
That's right.
Yeah. They must be Canadian.
Yeah, right.
Now, I just want to dive into the Sunday strips, because those, to me, going through his work seems to be like the really most impressive, where it just seems he just dives into there and just goes full out and does pretty much to his heart desire.
Mm-hmm.
When did he start, like, was the Sunday strips all along from the beginning, or is that something, a point where he went, okay, let's expand this, or the paper said, hey, let's expand this?
No, the daily strips predate the Sundays. The daily had been around since 1918, or is it sort of like a weekly panel and then a daily panel. But it was in 1920, right about two or three months before Skezik is introduced, that they started the Sunday. And I think the introduction of the Sunday has something to do with the fact that they were planning on introducing a baby, because the Sundays, as Chris indicated earlier, were aimed more at kids, whereas the daily strips were read by adults. And so in the early Sundays before Skezik, you see Uncle Walt playing with the neighborhood kids. And then once Skezik is introduced, you have Walt taking care of Skezik. So in a lot of ways, the Sunday strips came about because there was this idea of making Walt not just a bachelor, but a father figure, and introducing the theme of childhood, which is also very dear to Frank King's heart. And I think that's perhaps one reason why in the Sundays it sort of took, he started to experiment and do stuff the way he did, because he was very interested in exploring what it means to be a child and what it means to grow up. And the Sundays allowed him to do all these, like, you know, wonderful tableau scenes with balloons and circuses and traveling, and also these imaginative stories of where Skezik, you know, dreams he can fly or dreams he can go underwater.
Yeah.
When I picked up the first volume and started reading it, I couldn't. It was like 80-year-old jokes about cars. And when I started, it was kind of a mystery to me, the appeal of the strip. But I was just wondering, was it King's idea to introduce Skezik, or was that something to do with the publishers?
Well, there's maybe G should answer this, since he's more articulate and knows the history better. But as I understand it, there's sort of a story that circulated that Patterson at the Tribune suggested that he had a child to the strip, but I've also read that it was King's idea, so it's not quite sure. I mean, it's not quite certain what the origin of it was. I don't know. What do you think, G?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things to be said. One is Patterson was the sort of publisher or related to the publisher of the Tribune, and he was at the New York Daily News, and he kind of liked to claim credit for everything. So if you read these newspaper accounts, Patterson is supposedly the guy that told Chester Gould, you know, let's make him Dick Tracy rather than plainclothesman Tracy.
And sounds like a Stan Lee type.
Yeah,
character.
He's a Stan Lee sort of figure. Exactly. And whereas, like, from... So I kind of think that Patterson didn't have anything to do with it, and there's two pieces of evidence that we can kind of put forward. One is, even before Skezik is introduced, there are already children being introduced into Gasoline Alley. Bill and Amy had a child in 1920, the year before, and Frank King himself, the second piece of evidence is, he was very interested in childhood and child, because he and his wife had a son, Robert, in 1916, and from the moment Robert was born, King started introducing jokes into his work, into the panel he did called The Rectangle, about babies. So it seems like babies and little boys and growing up were all things that Frank King was interested in. So
I'm sorry, go ahead, G.
Oh, no, can you say what you have to say?
I was just going to add in that his probably his most successful strip before Gasoline Alley, and he did a number of them, was Bobby Make Believe, which was a Winsor McKay inspired strip about a little kid's dreams. And it's a lot of the ideas in Bobby Make Believe then went on to be recycled in Gasoline Alley. But it was clear that King wanted to maintain sort of a tie both to his own childhood, and I think also maybe write about his own child's childhood, because those strips started, I think, a couple of years, 1914 or something?
Yeah, 1915, I think, yeah.
And, of course, he and his wife also, their first child was stillborn, which is a biographical detail. adds to the meaning of the strip somewhat. So.
Which actually you cover quite eloquently in the was in the first book.
Yeah.
The research into there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and just to sort of add to what Chris has said, I think that there's two aspects to Bobby Make-Believe and Gassinelli that are both worth paying attention to. One is that King, like a lot of artists, he kept going back to his own childhood because that's sort of the time in life when, you know, we're most creative and we're most, like, alive to the world. And he really, like, went back to his childhood memories as a source of inspiration. And then later when he had the son, and there were all sorts of complications and issues with his relationship with his son, Robert, but in some ways, Gasoline Alley is also a way of trying to reach his son or to make some sort of statement about fatherhood and about the relationship between a father and a child. So Gasoline Alley was important to him both as a sort of statement about his own memories of childhood and also as a way of building a bridge to his son, I think.
Absolutely right.
Now, Chris, as a cartoonist point of view, looking at the relationship that he creates with his son, was there really any comparison for how he was able to develop this dynamic relationship between Walt and Skeezix, like that humanism to it, I guess?
You mean comparison with other strips at the time? Or?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe there is, but I'm not as well versed in the history of comics maybe as I should be, but I at least from my kind of cursory read of that era of comic strips, it seems pretty unique to me. I mean, it has a heart to it that other strips that followed it or came before it, strips like, you know, Little Orphan Annie and stuff, just don't quite seem to have to me. It seems to be much more based purely on the family unit and how, I think really in a lot of ways what the strip is about to me is about how a human relationship becomes important over time in a way that's completely indescribable, because you see Walt find Skeezix, you know, the day that it happens, and day by day he just becomes more and more attached to Skeezix, to the point where Skeezix is his whole life to him, and he can't imagine being away from him for any time at all. Yet when he first finds Skeezix, he's kind of an annoyance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The whole strip, as it builds in this sort of disposable medium of comic strips, it just to me seems such a beautiful metaphor for really the way life unfolds in a way, and then before you know it, it's kind of over, but then all that's left is just this feeling of affection, basically, for somebody else. So it's, I don't know, somehow you just miraculously took this disposable medium of comics and was able to put that feeling into it, and it was really the core of the strip. There's various experimental plots that sort of twine around that basic idea, but the fundamental feeling of the strip going well up into the 40s, 50s, and even later was that, I think. So,
is a part of that the artistic style, the rounded edges to his work, kind of giving it that warmth?
Well, I maybe very cursorily, but I think it's his writing more than anything. What I tried to say before about the mood of the strip, as a younger cartoonist, I was under the misapprehension that the way to create a quiet strip when I was trying to do things that were more just about real life was to either draw more realistically or draw more softly or kind of smooth things over a bit. But it was Frank King's drawing that made me realize that that wasn't what you needed to do at all. What you needed to do was pay attention to the tone and especially the rhythm of the strip. And you could draw as bluntly and as flatly and boldly as you wanted to, but it was how you ordered the pictures and strung them together that gave the strip its tone. And I think that really is that's like the most important thing that you can learn as a cartoonist, I think, at least if you're going to try to draw in that style. So otherwise you can end up doing some very kind of schmaltzy and emotionally confused sort of storytelling. So not that I don't, but
there's a couple of things that just sort of sprung to mind when Chris said all that. One is about the rhythm, where I think King had this like amazing sense of just observing in sort of like quiet moments and like not forcing a punchline. And in some ways, the best sort of point of comparison would be Charles Schulz, mm-hmm. who was a fan of Frank King and who clearly had that a very similar sort of Midwestern sensibility, which is very, very different than the sort of, you know, New York or Los Angeles, you know, like sensibility of a lot of other cartoonists who went for the big yucks and went for, you know,
the sharper
punchline.
Well, also I noticed like a lot more of the sharper edges where Schulz has, like I was saying before, that nice roundness.
Yeah.
To the art too.
Yeah. No, I think that there's definitely something there, and in terms of this quality of time that Chris mentioned, I mean, one thing we should make clear, because not everyone will know this, is that Gasoline Alley was the first comic strip where the characters aged. And so Skizik is like, you know, a baby in 1921, and then by the later 20s is a little boy, and then by the mid-1930s he's discovering girls, and, you know, and then by the late early 1940s he's in the army. So really the experience of reading the comic strip over 20 years is also the experience of living life over 20 years. And it's this amazing quality that comic strips have of being a daily art form, you know, and they're consumed day by day just as life is consumed day by day. Yeah. And in some ways, like drawing a daily comic strip is very much like keeping a daily diary, you know. It's not like each individual unit doesn't amount to much, but they accumulate. And again, I think someone like Schulz is a good point of comparison, that like what makes Peanuts really great is not any individual strip, but the way that, you know, the characters add up and accumulate over time. And there's very much a sense, there's a great new biography of Schulz that just came out, which really goes into his life. And if you read the biography and you go back and read Peanuts, you really get a sense that Peanuts was a daily diary for Charles Schulz. And that everything that concerned him in life was also coming out in the comic strip. And I think the same is true of Frank King. Like, I really have a sense that his, for him, the life and the comics were one.
Yeah, well, even in King's diaries, he would make notes about where he'd been or things that he'd seen. And on the same page, sometimes right under it, he would have a note about what was going to happen in the strip. Or he'd take a note about his wife Delia saying something, and then right under that it'll say something about Uncle Walt. We should also add here, because all of this stuff is so, we're so mired in it, we probably forget that listeners might not know, but many of the characters in the strip, including the main characters, were based on real life analogs of King's family. Mm-hmm. Uncle Walt is Frank King's wife's brother, so it was Frank King's brother-in-law, who was also his childhood friend. He grew up in Toma, Wisconsin, playing with Walter Drew.
I don't know if this makes much difference. It was a younger friend, too, which can kind of, I guess, kind of have that, like, kind of brotherly, little brother affection, where that kind of role that he plays in the strip, I see, kind of.
Yeah, possibly, right.
I don't know.
That's a good observation. Yeah, there's a real affection for Walt. That Frank King had for both the real Walt and for the comic strip
Mr. Wallet.
Yeah.
Walter Drew actually never married either. He lived with William Gannon and Gertie Gannon, who were also characters in the strip, his entire life. He was a telegraph operator, so I think he was you see pictures of him and you think, oh, well, he looks kind of not terribly eligible for marriage. Seemed like a very jocular fellow and seemed well-liked and everything, but he never had a family of his own, and sometimes I kind of wonder if this was kind of King's way of maybe granting him one a little bit. And he became, I think, something of a bit of a local celebrity in Chicago. There's a film made by the Tribune to promote its publishing empire. It was, I think it's 1925, where they actually filmed King's brother-in-law in a sailor hat looking like Uncle Walt with the real Bill.
Oh, how pacing back and forth with his arms behind his back.
Well, it's kind of a brief shot, but I think it's possibly there was somebody who read the comics on the Chicago Tribune on the WGN when it was a young radio station, who read them as Uncle Walt, and I'm wondering if it was actually the real Uncle Walt. I mean, there's no way of really knowing, but
which was different than what I played earlier.
That was a much later radio show, and I think King sold the franchise to somebody in the early 40s, which bears little or no resemblance to the tone of the comic strip. That seemed like they were trying to turn it into sort of a situation comedy or something. But in a lot of ways, comic strips are the origins of radio and then television situation comedy anyway.
One thing I noticed going back a little bit, because we're talking about the daily, like, you know, each year is a year, is one thing I noticed after reading 6 years straight of Gasoline Alley is that he doesn't handle things the same thing each year. It's like, it's his birthday, so we're going to do this for his birthday. It's like, he's very careful to make sure, you know, you catch a part of that day that's a different part of the day. Like, I guess the wedding, it wasn't just, here's the wedding, but it was like a part of the day in the wedding.
Right, that's interesting, yeah.
So I don't know if that was like a I guess that probably was a purposeful thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I would think so. I think he's trying to capture the details of life, I think. And sometimes they seem very mundane, and other times they seem almost kind of overly or overtly plot-driven. And in some cases, like the latter, seems a little overbearing. And the strips, and I think Jeet very well articulated that in the second book where he talked about Sidney Smith's influence on him, because at that time Smith was probably one of the best known, if not highest paid entertainers in America, and his strip The Gumps was sort of the standard by which all other comic strips were measured, and everybody was being influenced by the heavy plotting and sort of melodramatic drama of it. And I think King was probably affected by that as well, so.
I'm wondering about the Sunday strips, the influence of that you brought in from other, I guess, fields of art, because the one of the strips is where he goes to the museum. Walton Skeezix go to the museum and they kind of explore. Was it abstractism stuff? Was that something he was interested in, kind of wanted to like share with people through anything, or is it just his style he wanted to try exploring?
Well, I mean, Jeet can answer this well, but I mean, he went to art school in Chicago, so I'm sure that at the time, though, I think he may have taken some somewhat commercial classes. He seemed to carry the lessons of art school, like carrying a sketchbook, and there are a few pictures that survive of him sitting at an easel, where I think he was probably fairly well-schooled in what was going on in fine arts. And, I mean, it's tempting to imagine that the divisions between fine and commercial art were as distinct back then as they are now, but I sort of wonder that maybe they weren't quite as much, perhaps, because a lot of even the Ashcan School painters like George Lukes started out as newspaper illustrators. So I don't know. I think he was a well-educated guy. He read a lot. I know he was interested in Japanese art. He and his wife decorated Japanese pottery and collected it. But I don't know.
I think, I agree with everything you said, and I want to perhaps add a bit more to that, which is, first of all, like, at the time, there was a lot of overlap between, or interest, common interest between avant-garde culture and the comics. So you had Lionel Feininger, you know, who was very much a modern artist, but who did comic strips for the Chicago Tribune in the early part of the century. And you had, what was the big show that they had in New York, that caused all the controversy in 1913? The Armory Show?
The Armory Show.
Yeah, so the Armory Show also had a cartoonist that was involved, which is Rudolf Dierks, who did the Katzenjammer Kids.
He had a
painting in there. And I'm pretty sure that King and Claire Briggs and Sidney Smith went to the Armory Show because in 1913 they all did comic strips about modernism. And so I think that and there's a sort of a deeper affinity between the two, because in a lot of ways what the modernists were interested in doing was to move beyond representation and to have art that's more sort of iconic. And you have someone like Picasso who's like looking at African art as a way of like, you know, moving beyond representation towards more basic images. And that's in some ways what the cartoonists were doing as well. So you had this very strange affinity between comic strip artists and what's going on in modern art. And I think King's, the great Sunday page that you referred to really illustrates that. There's like all sorts of interesting tensions in there, because in that comic strip, Walt and Skeezek go to a museum and then they enter into the world of modern art. But Walt in particular is scared because it's so frightening and different. Yet clearly King wasn't scared because he was aware of this art and he used it in his own strip. So it's a very interesting tension.
Well, and then later in his life, too, when he retired from the strip, he did sculptures and painting and just kind of kept to himself, actually. And even during the time he was working on the strip, his notebooks are filled with ideas for odd little sculptures, and he even did shadow boxes and things like that in his free time. So
Yeah, that's right. I think that the one thing to emphasize about King as an artist is that he was he's a real sponge. Like, he really absorbed what was around him. And so you can see different things that he did where he's, like, looking at Winsor McKay and absorbing Winsor McKay, and he's looking at Clare Briggs and absorbing Clare Briggs. And then the same is also true of, like, looking at Picasso and absorbing Picasso. And the other aspect is that he was very restless. He was never content to do the, you know, keep repeating himself. But you really see that he, like, you know, is constantly fiddling with his style and trying to, like, experiment. Certainly up until about, like, the late 1930s, but maybe even beyond that. I mean, I think it's really a fact about King that he had this sort of, you know, restless creativity.
Well, I noticed in particular in the latest volume there seems to be more experimenting, even with the dailies, mm-hmm. the black and white dailies, mm-hmm. with the impressionistic strips.
Yeah, I think, again, he was really going for a very specific sort of mood there, or trying to extend the possibility of feeling in a comic strip with those drawings. And they're really beautiful, too. He just had any... The amazing thing is they're not over-rendered or they're not fussily done. They're almost kind of just, if you see the originals, they're almost kind of tossed off in a way, but they work so beautifully because they're just, they're so shot through with unpretentiousness. They're just so easy to look at. He's not trying to impress you, really. He's just trying to communicate something to you very, very clearly and naturally. It's
the passion, I guess.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, the use of the shadows is really interesting, just because usually the people that are credited with bringing, you know, sort of shadows into comic strips are Noel Sickles and Milton Caniff, who were supposedly influenced by sort of film and photography in the 1930s. But if you look at the latest Gasoline Alley Daily book, it's clear that already in the 1920s, Frank King was interested in this stuff and was playing with it, and in a lot of ways doing it better than I think Kniff did in the 1930s.
Yeah, because it actually had an emotional content and a point to it. It wasn't just the look of the strip as a style. And also in the teens in King's diary, when Robert was born, he was going to the, at least in his diary, I think he said he went to the movies nearly every single day. And mm-hmm. I think it was clear that he was pretty aware that that this was an art form that was going to take over, basically. And I think he was very interested in it. And I think his take on the cinema and his incorporation of filmic techniques into comic strips was sort of unique, actually. He wasn't just, like the later guys, he wasn't just imitating the camera framing and that sort of thing. He was looking at it in maybe a different way in terms of his own art rather than just simply imitating it. But
yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think photography is probably the other big influence, because he was a sort of, you know, like from a very early age, he was like taking photographs like crazy.
Yeah.
And really thinking about like what photographs do, and to plug our own books, we reprint a lot of these photographs in the Walton Skizek books, and they're great photographs, and they really show someone who's like thinking about the camera and the way it like captures light, and you know, how to stage pictures, but also a lot of like candid photographs that are very unique for their time, like that just capture casual moments in a very easy way.
Well, I think Jeet's introduction for the three books now is in excess of 60 pages. So already there's 180 pages of illustrated biography for just the first three volumes, and this has been very intentional on our part, because Jeet and I both felt very early on when we were talking about this that King's biography is as important to the strip as not. And I think given the possibility, after meeting Drew Anna King, of reproducing all this stuff, I think we really wanted to make these books as rich as possible and to try to get as much of a sense of King's real life, because he was referring to his own real life every single day in the strip. I think, I mean, it's, we just want to make it as detailed as possible, so.
And that's, in the, going through the stuff that, that Joanna's provided for you is included in the journals, and I'm wondering how much an aspect that has been, and what that's been like going through and studying, you know, this man's life.
Well, personally, for me, it's been great because you, as a cartoonist, you have a lot. You spend a lot of time by yourself, and you start to really think you're out of your mind because you don't have any real analog other than calling your friends up and seeing if they feel as crappy as you do, basically. And to see King kind of struggling with issues of procrastination or how he balanced his day out or how he would maybe start working on a strip in the morning and then not feel like doing it and then go out and shovel mud or rake leaves for a while just to kind of work off some energy and then spend time with his family is really, this is a cartoonist about whom I knew nothing for almost 15 years of my life, and any little scrap of information I could find I would cling on to try to get a sense of what he was like, and then now all of a sudden to be able to read these daily journals was really pretty amazing. I mean, we reproduced some of them in the second book a bit, and then also in this one, and I think we'll do more, but...
Is there a point where you have to be kind of selective because you get into his personal...
Well, sure. I mean, there's things that Druanne has told us that she said that were sort of, you know, off the record. But she, at the same time, I've even asked her a couple times, I said, look, are we overplaying this element of his biography? Because the one thing that we really haven't talked about yet, and the thing that I discovered about 10 years ago or so, is that this Gasoline Alley is a strip about a warm father-son relationship. And yet I found out that King had sent his own son away to military school when he was about 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a biographical tension there that doesn't really make sense on the surface. And in our discussions and talks and meetings with Druanna, she let us know in fairly clear language that King loved children and was loved by children, but his wife was not of that cut of cloth. In fact, it was pretty much entirely her doing to send their son away, which when you know that and then you read the strip, it's almost like adding water to a Japanese paper flower. It just suddenly kind of blooms when you know that detail. It makes a lot of sense because it was...
And it kind of breaks the heart at the same time.
Yeah, because in a way the strip then becomes King's imagined life with his own son who wasn't there anymore. And a lot of the nemesis in the strip, if there's anyone in the strip who could be called a villain, it's a woman who claims to be and is Skeezix's actual mother. And there's a tension there between the Walt of the strip and then the actual mother of the character Skeezix. So it's to me it's just really interesting how King consciously and maybe unconsciously funneled these details of both his real life and his private emotional struggle into this strip. And the more we found out about it, it makes the strip that much more powerful as a story. So
I'm surprised with King being such a major figure and Gasoline Alley being such a long-run, important strip in American cartoon history is why he hasn't... This hasn't happened before. Nobody's tried to do this before.
Well, I haven't either. I mean, I'm going to let Jeet answer this because he's really good at articulating the difference between the strips that became popular, say, like Buck Rogers and Milton Caniff. But, I mean, for years I wanted this to happen because to me it seemed like this was the real strip with heart. But it just kind of got swept under the rug. So
I think
this is a strip about cars. But anyway.
To sort of answer that question, I mean, I think there's two factors. One is maybe the sort of copyright issue where, like, Frank King owned the characters Walt and Skeezix, but the Chicago Tribune owned the comic strip. The logo, Gasoline Alley, the name Gasoline Alley. So King did books about Walt and Skeezix, children's books, which are very beautiful, but, you know, there was not a lot of incentive for him. Or there might have been trouble for if you wanted to do the book, but the other factor is just the way what comic strips get reprinted, which Chris alluded to. Like A lot of what gets reprinted depends on fans, and for a long time, fan culture was basically these guys who grew up in the 30s and 40s and who loved Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon when they were little boys, and then when they were older and had some money, wanted to put out books about Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers, which is all, you know, very nice and well. But when they were kids, they weren't reading Gasoline Alley because Gasoline Alley was for adults. And so this sort of the dominance of fan culture has sort of skewed our sense of comic strip history, that, you know, the comic strips that get written about and celebrated are the ones that fans who have a taste for superheroes remember.
Well, Gasoline Alley was hugely popular at one point, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was extremely popular.
Yeah.
I guess that was before the mass marketing of collected editions.
Yeah. I mean, you really didn't get a lot of... You had a few reprints of comic strips in the 20s and 30s, but the real sort of push to have, you know, like archival editions didn't start till the 70s, you know.
Yeah, and Gasoline Alley was pretty well passed over at that point in favor of other strips, you know.
Yeah.
Now,
to me, it just always seemed like it was one of the top five strips, but it was never really, you know... mentioned. And then, yeah, that's a shifting list, too. Who knows in 10 or 15, 20 years what the strips from the turn of the last century will be remembered. It might be a completely different list. It just depends on what lasts and what has emotional resonance and what has... Basically, it comes down to how much truth is in the strip. That's what really gives a work of art its life. And I don't think it's going out on a very long limb to say that there's probably a little more human truth in Gasoline Alley than there was in Flash Gordon. So.
No. And I think that the other aspect is to mention, which I already alluded to, is the sort of what artists are interested in. Because I think artists, in a lot of ways, invent their own ancestors. In a sense that, you know, someone like Dickens was once thought of as a popular entertainer, but because Kafka loved Dickens, we now recognize that Dickens was a precursor to Kafka, and there's a dark side to Dickens. And the same is true in comic strips, that if once you have artists like Chris and Seth and Joe Matt working, then Frank King will loom much larger, because we can see that there's a tradition, there's a genealogy. And I think in some ways even maybe the rise of the graphic novel has made Frank King more accessible, because once we put these stories together in a book, they read like graphic novels. They read like, you know, these, you know, year-long or two-year-long narrative.
The longest graphic novel.
Yeah.
We're coming close to the end of our time allotment. We have about 5-6 minutes left. And I just want to get a little more props to the Sundays collection coming out, because we really touched a lot on the daily stuff. Now, the Sundays, I think it's 96 pages?
Maybe 104 or something, I don't know. Yeah.
What was the choice and selection of which pages were chosen for that book?
I think, that was mostly Pete's doing, who's the editor, and then Jeet weighed in with some very good advice. Art Spiegelman gave in some advice, and I did a little bit, but a lot of it was, there's a lot of strips because of the Smithsonian collection, which was sort of my Bible when I was in college, because the strips I really liked the most were the newspaper strips, not comic books. Those certainly I wanted to be in there, and more just the experimental stuff, and it was more Pete's doing, I think, than anything, so...
Yeah, well, Pete, his earlier book was on Winsor McCay, and in some ways this is meant to be a little bit of a sequel to that. Mm-hmm. So he had the sort of a choice of a lot of strips that have a sort of fantasy element that take off from McCay. But I think we also wanted to include a lot of the strips that deal with the sort of father-son theme, which is so important. And so there was a choice of that. We also, like a lot of the strips... It had to be in there because they're so imaginative. Like, one of the things that Frank King would do is he'd do a Sunday page where the entire page told one story. Like, if you glanced at it, it'd be an overview scene, and then each panel was broken down. So we wanted to include as many of those as we could because that was really innovative.
Yeah.
So I think those were the sort of factors that we weighed.
Well, plus, I don't know. I think Frank King may be the only Sunday strip cartoonist to do strips about the colors of leaves.
That's something I was going to bring up was the fall collections, which we're doing this in October. very appropriate time to be discussing it, because I don't know what it's like where you guys are, but all the leaves are golden here.
I should add, I'm actually under a tornado watch right now.
Again?
Again, yeah.
In an odd bit of synchronicity, continuing to that, Vancouver is facing the end of some typhoon that ended up here.
Wow.
It's apocalypse.
Well, that's good. Well, at least when they take the core sample of our civilization a couple of hundred years in the future, for whoever survives, there'll be lots of really nicely reprinted comics from this last 2 years era.
But actually, to mention those color pages, which I'm glad you mentioned, said that, because that is one of like the real hallmarks of King's greatness, that he had this wonderful sense of color. And it's very different than other comic strips, especially the Hearst papers, where the colors are loud and vibrant and like a circus poster. He really had a sort of sense of the subtlety of colors. And he was helped by that, by the fact that the engravers at the Chicago Tribune were real craftsmen. And was it Frank King? He always buy like a bottle of whiskey for the engraving department?
Actually, that was Winsor McKay.
Oh, it was Winsor McKay. Yeah.
It works, too, actually. I did that a couple times for the printers at the Daily Texan in Austin. So they work really hard at it. I really like printers the times that I've met them. You know, everybody likes to get booze, too. So. Hmm.
Yeah. And you actually like went to Malaysia, wasn't it, for your most recent collections to kind of fine-tune?
I actually didn't. I went to China when the first two printings of Jimmy Corrigan were so way off. I went for the third printing and tried to correct all the mistakes. But Pete Maresca, the publisher of Sundays with Walt Kiesix, went to Malaysia to oversee the printing of all the pages, and he's done that for all of his books, which is why they come out so perfectly.
I should mention that very quickly. I know we don't have time, but Pete was really the sort of powerhouse behind this, and one reason why the Sunday books is so great is the amount of effort that Pete put into, like, restoring the pages, and, I mean, there's pages in there where he's put as much labor into fixing them and getting it right as King did in drawing them.
Yeah, easily.
Well, you were... I'm assuming that you didn't have originals to work from.
When you're speaking of originals in terms of Sunday strips, the original drawings were just black and white drawings, but these were scanned from best quality originals. Some are from my collection and some are from Joe Matt's collection.
And Spiegelman has actual colored page, doesn't he?
Those pages, though, when you say colored pages, those were actually colored by King 20 or 30 years after the fact for an exhibition that he had, I think, in Florida. So those colors were added by him for the gallery wall. The few Sunday pages that survive that are actually colored or might have a single panel colored, those were used as a guide for the engravers at the time, and I think those were colored after they were photographed, just simply because there was no such thing as a Xerox machine back then, and it was simply easier to color the original art than it would be to try to redraw something. That's getting very technical there for your listeners. So.
Oh, we have a fair amount of cartoonists that tune in quite regularly.
Well, that's
so
good. I'm glad that civilization has progressed to this point. So.
The world is being taken over by cartoonists and bad
aim,
weather.
Of course. So.
Mwaha. I want to thank you guys both for taking the time out of your busy days to sit with us for an hour of talk about Frank King.
Wow, an hour. Well, that was. Thank you so much for having us on. I really appreciate it. It was very nice of you.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, though.
And I hope someday to be as articulate and thoughtful as Jeet here.
Well, we all can't have a PhD.
I have no hope of being as great a cartoonist as Chris, so.
And I'll just...
being nice. Well, thank you again very much, and good luck in the pledge drive.
Oh, the pledge drive's done.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah, that's why I postponed to have you guys after the pledge drive, so I didn't have to stop every 15 minutes to ask for money.
Subscribers by the million.
Surprising, actually, this show did okay for a pledge drive for yakking about comics. I was surprised.
We were giving away good stuff.
Yeah, we had some Drawing Quarterly and Fantagraphics stuff to give away to kind people. So, but I digress. Thank you very much, guys, and I hope you both have safe, calm weather days. I'm looking forward to rafting my way to work after this, I think.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye. Just once again to remind everyone, that was Chris Ware and Jeet here. Jeet is currently working on his PhD, master cartoonist, academic, who... has done wonderful work on the Walton Skeezix collections, three daily collections as well as the new Sundays collection. This daily, the third volume of the daily just came out, as well as the Sundays collection. The Sundays is gorgeous. It's massive, it's huge, and you'll love it.
Well, that is the original size.
Yeah.
With these, yeah. I mean, it's as a book, it's in fantastically large, but that's how they used to print them, the old strips.
I guess we're at the end of our time.
Oh.
So thanks, guys, for coming on. Also, if you're interested, check out Walton Skezik's stuff as well. Both of them have been involved in the George Harriman Crazy Cat collections, which I actually meant to ask a couple questions about because I noticed in book three, they go to Coconino County, which is where Crazy Cat takes place.
Oh.
Yeah. So next week, I'll be playing an interview I did with, or Colin and I did with Mr. Brian Talbot. And actually, be only one part of the interview. The second part will be available online at inkstuds.com. This is CITR 101.9 FM. Up next is Crimes and Treasons. Now I'm going to end the show with a song, a sad song, because Lady J. Briar Orridge just passed away last week. She's the partner of Genesis Peorage, one of my favorite people, and she's been really influential in kind of furthering his development and really, like, I guess, his rock. And it's really sad when someone young passes away. So I'm going to play Milk Baba off the latest Psychic TV album. And any last words, Colin?
Good night.
Good night and good luck. Oh, and then before that, I'm going to play something funny. I got Stumptown. I think you guys will like it.
Hi, this is Peter Bagg, friend of Ink Studs, and you can catch Ink Studs on Wonderful What?
CITR.
Wonderful CITR. How was that?
Fantastic.